Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Well, here we are, a year and a half away from Election Day, and we're already being bombarded with news from the campaign trail, like new candidates throwing their hats into the ring. And there's no shortage of controversial political books either, like the Hillary and Bill bashing Clinton Cash by Peter Schweitzer. While we're not going to preview that title, we will focus on Washington books that are getting people talking. You'll enjoy samples from impactful new histories from Pulitzer Prize winners, some fascinating insider looks at the White House, and page-turning political fiction. My guest today has written an international thriller with Washington's dirty dealings front and center. Let's journey inside the Beltway now as we turn to page one of the book report. Best-selling biographer H.W. Brands, twice finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, is just out with Reagan, The Life, an intriguing, in-depth look at the conservative icon, celebrated for transforming the American domestic agenda. Brands argues Reagan, along with FDR, was the most consequential president of the 20th century. Whether or not you agree, Reagan took office at a time when the public sector, after a half century of New Deal liberalism, was widely perceived as bloated and inefficient, an impediment to personal liberty. Reagan sought to restore democracy by bolstering capitalism. Brands follows Reagan as his ambition for ever larger stages compelled him from a troubled childhood in small-town Illinois to radio announcer and then movie star. In Hollywood, Reagan edged closer to public service as president of the Screen Actors Guild before a stalled film career led to his unlikely reinvention as the voice of General Electric and a spokesman for corporate America. Reagan follows his subject on his improbable political rise from the 1960s, when he was first elected governor of California, to his triumphant election in 1980 as president. Brands employs archival sources not available to previous biographers and dozens of interviews with surviving members of the administration. The result is an informative narrative performed by Stephen Hoya that offers a new understanding of a crucially important president.
The silence of his listeners caused him to talk through his laugh lines, making the awkwardness worse. During his years with GE, he had abandoned the pro-government liberalism of his young adulthood in favor of a pro-business conservatism. In doing so, he accumulated note card decks of statistics documenting government waste and excess. On this occasion, he rattled the statistics off in numbing order. Then, without warning, he swerved from domestic politics to foreign policy, leaving his audience confused as to what the American federal debt had to do with the Castro Revolution in Cuba. His gestures didn't suit his words, and his principal gesture, a wagging of the right index finger, looked decidedly schoolmarmish. Yet something happened midway into the half-hour speech. A belated mention of Goldwater got the crowd to respond, and their encouragement calmed Reagan down. He gave his jokes their moments to sink in. Anytime you and I question the schemes of the do-gooders, we're denounced as being against their humanitarian goals, he said. They say we're always against things. We're never for anything. Well, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so. The audience perked up the more. American conservatives were a combative tribe who didn't speak of liberals as their friends, but here Reagan did. His tone was serious, but it wasn't angry, the way Goldwater's often was. Reagan criticized Democratic leaders, but he didn't criticize Democrats. He condemned the direction the American government was going, but he professed confidence in the American people. At the outset, he had said that the Goldwater campaign had not provided him with a script. The words he spoke were his own. He didn't say they were words he had tested on hundreds of audiences, but the polish showed. This idea that government is beholden to the people, that it has no other source of power except the sovereign people, is still the newest and the most unique idea in all the long history of man's relation to man, he said. This is the issue of this election, whether we believe in our capacity for self-government or whether we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves. He made his points with images and examples. We have so many people who can't see a fat man standing beside a thin one without coming to the conclusion the fat man got that way by taking advantage of the thin one, he said, in a swipe at government redistribution schemes. Government welfare programs were a racket. A judge called me here in Los Angeles. He told me of a young woman who'd come before him for a divorce. She had 6 children, was pregnant with her 7th. Under his questioning, she revealed her husband was a laborer earning $250 a month. She wanted a divorce to get an $80 raise. She's eligible for $330 a month in the Aid to Dependent Children program. She got the idea from 2 women in her neighborhood who'd already done that very thing. A job training program was typically profligate. We're going to spend each year just on room and board for each young person we help, $4,700 a year. We can send them to Harvard for $2,700. He cracked a smile. Of course, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting Harvard is the answer to juvenile delinquency. The audience laughed and applauded. Some remembered to wave their Goldwater signs, but most were focused on the man in front of them. No government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size, Reagan said. So government programs, once launched, never disappear.
We've just heard Reagan, The Life, by H.W. Brands. Topol is the author of 11 novels of international intrigue. He graduated from Carnegie Tech with a major in chemistry, but then he abandoned science and went on to earn a law degree from Yale. Now a partner in a major Washington law firm, Alan travels extensively to research locations for his novels. Today we'll speak with Alan about his new bestseller, The Washington Lawyer. Alan, welcome to the Book Report.
Very happy to be with you, Elaine. Thanks for having me.
The Washington Lawyer is your 11th novel. What inspired you to first begin writing thrillers?
Well, I actually was writing nonfiction articles and for newspapers and magazines. And then I became convinced that the novel in the thriller genre is a more effective way to convey something I had to say about a geopolitical issue. At the same time, I could write an entertaining story and a page-turner, and I was inspired by Graham Greene and Leon Uris that fiction could be a great vehicle to entertain, but at the same time, inform. And so that's kind of what got me going quite a number of years ago.
Let's get into The Washington Lawyer. Introduce us to Allison Boyd.
Okay, Allison Boyd, the three-sentence story is a young woman named Vanessa, who's a Senate staffer, goes off for a weekend in the Caribbean with a powerful senator. Something happens to her, and her twin sister, Allison, is determined to find out what it is. Allison is a mid-30s. She's a professor of archaeology at Brown University who, as the novel begins, is off on a dig in Israel. And Allison is absolutely determined to find out what happened to her sister. She's a powerful self-starter, had been on a U.S. Olympic team for field hockey. But I wanted to work in this relationship between two sisters. I've had 3 daughters. I've watched them growing up. I've watched how close they are. I've watched how they support and cover each other. And I wanted to work this very much into the novel and make Allison my heroine who clashes with powerful forces in Washington.
She is a great character. Do you have plans to bring her back in an upcoming novel?
Well, that's funny you should say, because, Elaine, my next novel, the 12th, that will be coming out next March, is called The Italian Divide. And I'm picking up after 4 novels with my hero, Craig Page. But after that, I am planning to write a sequel to The Washington Lawyer because, frankly, the novel's done so well. It got a fabulous review on The Washington Post on March 16th, which kind of propelled the novel. And so I am now working on a sequel. I am definitely planning to bring Allison back because, like you, I really enjoyed Allison as a character. I enjoyed working with her and creating her as a character.
At the core of The Washington Lawyer is a U.S. senator who sells military secrets to the Chinese. Was any of his story based on an actual incident?
What it was based on is this. I did a lot of research for this novel, as I do for my others. And as I began researching about the current geopolitical situation in the U.S., where China is our main rival, what I learned is that Chinese spying in the United States, directed by their MSS, their Ministry of State Security, is huge. They have really replaced the KGB as the biggest kind of foreign spies in the United States. And surprisingly, this has not been written about very much in the media, and certainly it hasn't been in movies or in novels. One of my objectives in writing The Washington Lawyer was to provide a wake-up call to Americans that there is an enormous amount of Chinese spying going on in the United States. And it's important because as this new century moves along, the Chinese have become our rivals economically, militarily, and politically around the world. And so I have my novel is a little bit of a wake-up call about Chinese spying in the U.S.
We're speaking with Alan Topol on The Book Report. You know, your character, Andrew Martin, is an intriguing guy. He's a prominent attorney being considered for a Supreme Court appointment. But as the story develops, his ethics are being chipped away. Alan, with your perspective as a Washington insider, do you believe there are D.C. power players who always play it straight?
I think they are. There are. But here's where I loved creating the Andrew Martin character, because your question, Elaine, exactly focuses on what my objective and what I was trying to do in the novel. Andrew Martin, as the novel begins, has always played it straight throughout his career, and that's why he's now on the short list to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And then something happens, this incident in the Caribbean involving Vanessa and his good friend. And as a result of that, he has to face the question, is he willing to abandon the moral code he always lived with and do something to aid his friend and try to cover this up, to do it in a way that will keep alive his chances to be Chief Justice? And as you said, chip away is a good expression that you just used, Elaine, because what happens is we find, as Martin faces this moral dilemma, bit by bit, he sort of slides into an abyss of immorality. And here's a very good person. And there's a bigger point here, and that's we can have upstanding, good moral people, but when faced with a chance to grab the gold ring, the thing that they always have strived for their entire life, are they willing to make compromises, and how far will they go? And so that's the moral issue. That's really one of the moral issues that's at the heart of this novel.
Well, I know we've talked about your next two novels, but with 2016 coming up fast, wouldn't you like to base a new novel on a presidential election?
Well, I actually, thinking about that, I have been, that's so funny. You're very propitious because in the sequel to The Washington Lawyer that I'm thinking about, I'm actually going to work into it, a presidential election, and a candidate who's going to be up for president, because it is such a very, very hot topic. I mean, Washington provides all sorts of wonderful stuff. For example, you know, the recent indictment of Senator Menendez from New Jersey. I mean, that's almost straight out of my book, The Washington Lawyer. The question is, what do powerful people do for their friends? How do they help their friends? And so Washington provides a great vehicle for information and material for a novel. But in terms of your question, I'm exactly right with you, because I'm now focusing on a presidential election, and I'm focusing on fundraising and how to work those into the sequel to The Washington Lawyer.
I'm wondering if your law firm clients know about your writing, and do any of them or your colleagues worry that they'll end up as one of your characters?
No, well, actually, that's a funny thing, because I've been writing for a long time, to produce 11 novels, and I've been a partner in the Washington Law Firm. And I was kind of wondering what reaction my clients and partners would have to my novel writing. And what really surprised me is how supportive both were. One of the most interesting things is reaction of clients, because a number of my clients became very, very good readers. And so I would often set a meeting with one of them, a lunch meeting. I travel up to New York, for example. This is coming very much to mind, to meet with a client who was the general counsel of a big corporation. And I wanted to discuss new legal opportunities for us with this client. And we sat down to lunch, and all the client wanted to do was talk about the novel, how I developed the novel and how it went. So it went very, very well.
So any final thoughts on The Washington Lawyer?
No, my only thought is I'm really delighted with the reception it's gotten. I would love it if any of your listeners read the book. If they wanted to give me feedback, I have a website, www.allantopol.com, AllanTopol. I love hearing from readers from listeners or readers, because it's a way to shape what I do going forward. And writing novels, as you well know, Lane, can be a relatively lonely thing. And to get that feedback from readers is just terrific. So I would encourage any of your listeners, if they read The Washington Lawyer, please come to me on reader mail through the website and give me that feedback.
Well, Allan, I really enjoyed your book, and I want to thank you for visiting with us today.
Thanks very, very much, Elaine, and I hope we can do it again next year when the next one comes out.
Absolutely. Thanks, Allan.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Allan's book is not yet out on audio, so let's listen to another popular political thriller, 12 Days, Alex Berenson's ninth book in the John Wells series. Wells, with his former CIA bosses Ellis Schaefer and Vinnie Duto, has uncovered a staggering plot, a false flag operation to convince the president to attack Iran. They have no hard evidence, and no one at Langley or the White House will listen. Now the president has set a deadline for Iran to give up its nuclear program, and the mullahs in Tehran, furious and frightened, have responded with a deadly terrorist attack. Wells, Schaefer, and Duto know they have only 12 days to find the proof they need. They fan out from Switzerland to Saudi Arabia, Israel to Russia, desperately trying to tease out the clues in their possession. Meanwhile, the U.S. is moving soldiers and Marines to Iran's border, and Iran has mobilized its own squad of suicide bombers. As the days tick by and the obstacles mount, they realize that everything they do may not be enough. George Guidall narrates.
He wanted to end his career as something other than a glorified bus driver. Mumbai was a lot of things, but it was really boring. Twice, he'd had to abort landings for slum kids running across the runway, airport cops chasing him like a scene from a bad movie. His co-pilot, Henry Franklin, was also ex-Navy, just young enough to have flown sorties in the first Gulf War. They'd shared the cockpit 3 days earlier, and Cuse was happy to have Franklin with him for the ride back. 99 times out of 100, a civilian with a week of training could have done what they were about to do, but the 100th time defined the job. A good pilot felt a crisis coming before his instruments did, and diffused it before it became serious enough to be a threat. Cuse had that sixth sense, and he saw it in Franklin, though the guy was a bit sharp to the crew. Now they sat side by side in the cockpit, making final pre-flight checks, their relief crew sitting at the back of the cockpit. A flight this long required another captain and first officer. Their Boeing 777 was just about full, making weight and balance calculations easy. 261 passengers, 17 crew members. 278 human souls traveling 8,000 miles over the Hindu Kush, the Alps, the Atlantic. They would fly in darkness from takeoff to landing, the sun chasing them west, never catching them. Every time you leave the Earth, it's a miracle, Hughes's first instructor at Pensacola had told him. You come back down, that's another. A miracle of human invention, human ingenuity, human cunning. Never forget that, no matter how routine it may seem. Always respect it. Captain, Franklin said, we're topped up. An 8,000-mile flight into the jet stream required the 777 to leave Mumbai with full tanks, 45,000 gallons of aviation-grade kerosene. The fuel itself weighed 300,000 pounds, accounting for almost half the jet's takeoff weight. They were carrying fuel to carry fuel, an inherent problem with long-range flights. Hughes glanced at his watch, a platinum Rolex, his wife's present to him on the day they signed their divorce papers. 9 years later, he still didn't know why she'd given it to him, or why he'd kept it. 11:36 p.m., 4 minutes before scheduled departure. They'd leave on time. By Mumbai standards, they had a good night to fly, 70 degrees, a breeze coming off the Indian Ocean to push away smog from trash fires and diesel-spewing minibuses. He looked over his displays one more time. Perfect. Hughes liked to keep the cockpit door open as long as possible, a throwback to the days when pilots didn't regard every passenger as a potential terrorist. Now the purser poked his head inside. Cabin ready for pushback, sir. Thank you, Carl. You can close the door. Yes, sir. The purser switched on the cockpit lock and pulled shut the door. Cockpit locked, Captain, Franklin said. In aviation lingo, he was the pilot monitoring with the job of talking to the tower and watching the instruments. Hughes was the pilot flying, responsible for handling the plane. Thank you, Henry. Greetings, United Flight 49. I'm Carl Fisher, your purser. We've closed the cabin door and are making final preparations for our flight to Newark. At this point, United requires you to put your cell phone on airplane mode. To make the flight more relaxing for you and everyone around you, we don't allow in-flight calls, but you are free to use approved electronic devices once we've taken off. The captain has informed me that he's expecting our flight time to be 16 hours. We do recommend that you keep your seatbelt fastened for the duration of the flight in case we run into any rough air, as is common over the Himalayas. Vic thumbed in one last text to his mother. On the plane, see you tomorrow. And then turned off his phone. Even if his stomach settled down, he doubted he'd sleep. He was caught between the cabin wall and a chubby 20-something woman wearing a Smith College sweatshirt and hemp pants. She smelled of onion chutney and positive thinking. She caught him looking at her and extended a hand, exposing a dirty Livestrong bracelet. We're going to be neighbors for 16 hours. We should know each other's names. Jessica. Vic awkwardly twisted his arm across the seat to shake. Vic, let me guess, yoga retreat? That obvious? How about you? I came to visit family. That's so wonderful, getting to see the place where you're from. Sure is. Despite himself, Vic liked this woman. He wished he could have seen the country through her eyes instead of his own.
That was 12 Days by Alex Berenson. In Capital Dames, the Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868, Cokie Roberts offers a riveting look at the experiences, influence, and contributions of the women of Washington during this momentous period. With the outbreak of the Civil War, the small, social southern town of Washington found itself caught between warring sides in a four-year battle that would determine the country's future. After the Declaration of Secession, many Southern women left the city, leaving their friends to grapple with questions of safety and sanitation as the Capitol was transformed into an immense Union Army camp and later a hospital. The women of Washington joined the cause, enlisting as nurses, supply organizers, relief workers, and journalists. Many risked their lives making munitions in a highly flammable arsenal. toiled at the Treasury Department, and plied their needlework skills at the Navy Yard. Roberts, who performs the book, chronicles these women's increasing independence, their political empowerment, and their indispensable role in keeping the Union unified during the war.
The sleepy little pre-war capital city went from being a social center for self-described belles to a place where purposeful women assembled to effect change. And it was not just the city that was transformed, it was also the women themselves. The antebellum belles spent their days calling on cabinet and congressional wives or listening to debates in the Capitol galleries and their nights at dinners and dances. Deeply political, they promoted their husbands' and fathers' careers and competed with each other for preeminent position in the capital city's close-knit social circles. "Everyone here is well-read and well-informed," one of the leading belles' mothers wrote to her husband on a visit to Washington in 1854. Verena Davis was expecting a new baby, and her mother was charmed by the city where her daughter lived. "Talent makes the aristocracy here. Money has its admirers, too, but talent outranks it." Women of talent could shine in the social gatherings that were dominated by Southerners who seemed to have been in Washington forever. Even many of the congressional newcomers and their wives knew each other because their fathers had been there before them. And some of the women had been schoolmates at the Visitation Convent in Georgetown, which educated girls of all faiths and from all regions. Then secession forced the Southern women to depart, and their friends in the city they left behind were soon grappling with questions of safety and sanitation, as the Capitol was transformed first into a huge army camp bursting with frisky fresh soldiers, and then a massive hospital reeking with wounded young warriors. Women engaged in all kinds of activities. Nurses, supply organizers, relief workers, pamphleteers all aided the cause, and female journalists covered it. Dorothea Dix and Clara Barton became powerful forces helping the soldiers. Anna Ella Carroll provided the propaganda. And the Civil War boasted its own rendition of Rosie the Riveter, women who did the dangerous work of making munitions at arsenals, many losing their lives in awful accidents. An earlier version of the government girls also were called to the Federal City, women who worked at the Treasury Department, taking the place of men who had joined the Army, just as the agency added the enormous job of printing greenbacks to pay for the war. The Washington Navy Yard broke with tradition as well, and hired women to sew canvas bags for gunpowder. As enslaved people sought refuge behind Union lines and other slaves made their way north, Washington beckoned as the promised land for tens of thousands of the so-called contrabands. After emancipation was declared in Washington in 1862 and the numbers of newcomers swelled, African-American women like Elizabeth Keckley joined with their white counterparts to found societies aimed at improving conditions in camps crowded with these displaced persons. And, struggling to establish schools and orphanages to handle the children, many women concluded that changes in public policy were needed in order for any real progress to occur. So they stepped up their lobbying and activism, with suffragists coming to the Capitol to press their case. The city of Washington would never be the same. The population almost doubled as a result of the war, and the size of the federal government exploded. When I was a little girl, the National Mall was marred by ugly temporary buildings that were hastily erected during the two world wars and marked the rapid growth of government over the previous few decades. The Civil War had the same impact. The federal budget, which had been $78 million in 1860, grew to almost $377 million in 1867 after spending for the war had ended. Measures spurring on industrial and agricultural production, plus new initiatives like the Homestead Act and the creation of land-grant colleges, required new federal agencies and an influx of bureaucrats to run them. No longer a small southern town, where everyone important knew everyone else, Washington bustled with the energy of parvenus who paraded through the halls of the Capitol and rose in the ranks of Congress.
We've just heard Capitol Dames by Cokie Roberts. From Pulitzer Prize-winning American historian Joseph J. Ellis comes The Quartet, orchestrating the Second American Revolution, 1783 to 1789. It's the unexpected story of why the 13 colonies, having just fought off the imposition of a distant, centralized governing power, would decide to subordinate themselves anew. In 1776, 13 American colonies declared themselves independent states that only temporarily joined forces in order to defeat the British. Once victorious, they planned to go their separate ways. The triumph of the American Revolution was neither an ideological nor a political guarantee the colonies would relinquish their independence and accept the creation of a federal government with power over their autonomy as states. The Quartet focuses on George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison. These men shaped the contours of American history by diagnosing the systemic dysfunctions created by the Articles of Confederation, manipulating the political process to force the calling of the Constitutional Convention, conspiring to set the agenda in Philadelphia, orchestrating the debate in the state ratifying conventions, and drafting the Bill of Rights. Ellis has written a gripping portrait of one of the most crucial and misconstrued periods in American history. The Quartet, narrated by Robertson Dean, lies at the heart of understanding the creation of the United States of America.
Truth be known, nationhood was never a goal of the War for Independence, and all the political institutions necessary for a viable American nation-state were thoroughly stigmatized in the most heartfelt convictions of revolutionary ideology. The only thing holding the American colonies together until 1776 was their membership in the British Empire. The only thing holding them together after 1776 was their common resolve to leave that empire. Once the war was won, that cord was cut, and the states began to float into their own, at best, regional orbits. Any historically informed prophet who was straddling that post-war moment could have safely predicted that North America was destined to become a Western version of Europe, a constellation of rival political camps and countries, all jockeying for primacy. That, at least, was the clear direction in which American history was headed. To say that something happened to change that direction is obviously inadequate. The beauty of the Lincoln version of the story is its presumption that a national ethos was already embedded in the political equation, albeit latently or implicitly, so that what we might call the Second Revolution of 1787 to 88 followed naturally from the first in 1776. But for all the political, ideological, and demographic reasons already noted, the transition from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution cannot be described as natural. Quite the contrary, it represented a dramatic change in direction and in scale. In effect, from a confederation of sovereign states to a nation-sized republic, indeed the largest republic ever established. So how do we explain such a seismic shift in the gravitational field of American political history? Well, the kind of bottom-up explanation that worked so well to convey popular opposition to British imperial policy in the 1760s and 1770s will not work in the 1780s. Mobs did not appear, urging the creation of a fully empowered American nation. Quite the opposite. The dominant historical forces in the 1780s were centrifugal rather than centripetal, meaning that the vast majority of citizens had no interest in American nationhood. Indeed, they regarded the very idea of a national government as irrelevant to their local lives and ominously reminiscent of the British Leviathan they had recently vanquished. There was no popular insurgency for a national government because such a thing was not popular. The obvious alternative explanation is top-down. All democratic cultures find such explanations offensive because they violate the hallowed conviction that, at least in the long run, popular majorities can best decide the direction that history should take. However true that conviction might be over the full span of American history, and the claim is contestable, it does not work for the 1780s, which just might be the most conspicuous and consequential example of the way in which a small group of prominent leaders, in disregard of popular opinion, carried the American story in a new direction. There is an ironic precedent for this argument. During the first half of the 20th century, Charles Beard and his disciples, chiefly Merrill Jensen, created a school of thought called the Progressive School that dominated our understanding of the Revolutionary Era. While much of their work has not aged well, chiefly it's claimed that the founders were driven primarily by economic motives, two features of their storyline remain abidingly relevant. First, that the founders must not be regarded as demigods with unique access to supernatural wisdom, and second, that the transition from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution was orchestrated by a political elite that collaborated, to say conspired seems sinister, but it is what the progressives meant, to replace a state-based confederation with a federal government that claimed to speak for the American people as a collective whole.
That was a sampling of The Quartet by Joseph J. Ellis. Kissing Cousins, The Untold Story of Eleanor Roosevelt and Alice Roosevelt Longworth by Mark Pizer and Timothy Dwyer is the provocative double biography of two extraordinary women whose tangled lives provide a sweeping look at the 20th century. When Theodore Roosevelt became president in 1901, his beautiful and flamboyant daughter was transformed into Princess Alice, arguably the century's first global celebrity. 32 years later, her first cousin Eleanor moved into the White House as First Lady. Born 8 months and 20 blocks apart from each other in New York City, Eleanor and Alice spent a large part of their childhoods together. But their politics and temperaments couldn't have been more distinct. Do-gooder Eleanor was committed to social justice, but hated the limelight. Acid-tongued Alice, who became the wife of philandering Republican Congressman Nicholas Longworth, was an opponent of big government who gained notoriety for her cutting remarks. While Eleanor revolutionized the role of First Lady with her passion for human rights, Alice made the most of her insider connections to influence politics, including doing as much as she could to defeat the League of Nations. Suzanne Torn performs the book.
The roster of invited guests might have been small, but it was A-plus list. President and Mrs. Kennedy arrived on Air Force One, which was taking its maiden voyage, and would be used almost exactly 1 year later to transport JFK's body back from Dallas. Vice President and Mrs. Johnson came, as did the former presidents Truman and Eisenhower, making this the first time that three presidents attended the funeral of a First Lady. Chief Justice Warren, Secretary of State Rusk, Secretary of Defense McNamara, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, Governor Rockefeller of New York, the United Nations Ambassador Stevenson, and a sizable contingent of the Washington establishment were there. One well-aimed Soviet missile would have decimated the U.S. government. That was no idle concern. Mrs. Roosevelt's funeral came at the tail end of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Just days earlier, Nikita Khrushchev had agreed to dismantle the Soviet missiles he'd lined up in Cuba like cigars ready to be lit. And Castro was still threatening to shoot down anything bigger than a kite that wandered into his airspace. The U.S. military was so concerned, the Pentagon wanted to install a kind of hotline in the pew at St. James's, where President Kennedy was to be seated. The Reverend Gordon Kidd said no. If he had to talk on the phone during the service, it would be terribly frustrating and confusing, Kidd reasoned. The feds settled for a phone placed unobtrusively on an outside wall of the church, though Eleanor would undoubtedly have scoffed at that, too. After all, Khrushchev didn't scare her. She had visited him on his home turf in 1957 for a magazine interview, a somewhat tense meeting that ended with Khrushchev's declaring his own sort of détente with one of the world's most formidable women. At least, he said, we didn't shoot each other. When he popped in for a visit at her woodsy Valkill cottage 2 years later, Eleanor had only one real worry. She realized she had no vodka. Even though Khrushchev was coming at 7 a.m., her son, John, dutifully ran down a bottle. Given all the world leaders Eleanor met and hosted over the years, it's hardly surprising that she received what was arguably the first power funeral of an American woman. What was notable was that one of Washington's most influential women was among the few who declined to attend. Her name was Alice Longworth. Mrs. L., as she was known, was a battle-ready Republican, a Capitol Hill institution with a biting wit, and a woman who, like Eleanor, tossed aside gender barriers as easily as she flicked the ashes off her long-stemmed cigarette holder. She was also Eleanor's first cousin. Alice's father, Theodore Roosevelt, was the older brother of Eleanor's father, Elliot. To her cousin Eleanor, Alice was a childhood playmate, a teenage confidant, and, in adulthood, a relentless rival. Their relationship had taken a sharp turn for the worse 30 years earlier, when Franklin Roosevelt was elected president, a job Alice believed rightly belonged to her favorite brother, Theodore Roosevelt, Jr. Over the years, the press played Alice and Eleanor off each other like rivals in a blue-blooded version of Oz, the good witch and the bad witch. Eleanor was the saint, the woman who revolutionized the role of First Lady with her very public activism, obvious concern for the poor and oppressed, and outspoken passion for human rights.
That was Hissing Cousins by Mark Pizer and Timothy Dwyer. Nicole Wallace's Madam President tells the story of a single day in the life of America's 45th president, Charlotte Creamer. The day commences before sunrise, with more than a dozen news crews embedded with the president, VP, and White House senior staff to chronicle a typical day at the center of American political power. While the president is delivering a speech in downtown D.C., the day takes a horrifying turn when multiple terrorist attacks are reported from 5 different U.S. cities. With the cameras and press corps closely watching her every move, the president navigates the ongoing threat to the nation she's vowed to protect and defend. Tavia Gilbert narrates.
Are my latest changes to the speech in the version that's in the teleprompter? Charlotte asked as she held up a draft with her edits marked in black ink. Yes, Madam President, I input your final revisions myself, Melanie replied in her usual calm manner. What time are we doing this? Charlotte was tapping her perfectly polished fingernails on the desk and swinging one of her legs back and forth underneath it as she reread her remarks. Melanie recognized both behaviors as two of Charlotte's relatively well-disguised nervous tics. You'll go on the air at 11:02 to give the anchors a couple of minutes to set things up and announce that you are addressing the nation live from the Oval Office. What time is it now? It's 10 minutes before 11, Madam President. Charlotte nodded and looked down at the text once more. After about 20 seconds, she looked up again. I'm sorry, Mel, how much time until we go live? About 10 minutes, Madam President. Can I get you something to drink? I'm fine. For the first time since they'd met nearly 6 years earlier, Melanie worried about Charlotte's ability to perform her official duties with her trademark steadiness. They were alone in the Oval Office, and it was Melanie's job to get the president through the next 25 minutes. It wasn't Melanie's actual job, but this wasn't a typical day. Melanie served as the Secretary of Defense, a post she'd held for the last 18 months, ever since Charlotte had been reelected for a second term as the country's 45th president. Melanie's Oval Office assignment was as unexpected as the events of the previous 12 hours. The sound of jets patrolling the airspace above the White House and the beams of light from the helicopters hovering nearby weren't helping with Charlotte's unusually high levels of agitation and impatience. Madam President, I need you to relax a little bit, or you're going to scare people more. Jesus Christ, Melanie! Charlotte exploded. Maybe it's good that she's blowing off a bit of steam, Melanie thought. Without any of our guys having a clue or hint of warning, terrorists attacked 5 cities. Hundreds, maybe thousands of people are dead. And we don't have any idea if there are more plots underway or where the attacks originated. People should be scared.
I crossed that section out of your speech. Thought it might be a little too much straight talk for tonight, Melanie deadpanned. Charlotte didn't smile. She stared down at the pages of her speech, but Melanie could tell she wasn't reading them. Melanie moved toward one of the sofas in the middle of the Oval Office and ran her hand back and forth across the smooth linen fabric that she'd selected when Charlotte had tasked her with renovating the room at the beginning of her first term. The president hadn't given her any direction other than to stick to one color. She had a thing for monochromatic dressing that extended to her interior decorating preferences. The fabric was so pale and delicate that the sofas needed to be recovered quarterly, but Charlotte said that they sent a strong signal to everyone to keep their feet off the furniture. She'd thwarted several attempts to recover them in a more practical material. The down-filled couches were inviting, but Melanie knew that if she sat, her 24-hour day would catch up with her, and she'd never be able to muster the energy to get back up. She glanced down at her BlackBerry. Her executive assistant made fun of her for still carrying the antiquated device, but she'd had a BlackBerry, at times she'd had 2 or 3 of them, since her first days at the White House almost 2 decades earlier. Now she also carried an iPhone that her husband Brian had given her the year before, and that she used for personal communications with him and with their friends and family. Melanie scrolled through the email messages on the iPhone and opened a message from Brian. He was in the White House briefing room, about 40 feet away from the Oval Office, with the rest of the White House correspondents. His message simply said, "Good luck with the speech. Call when you can. Love you."
We've just heard Madam President by Nicole Wallace. No one has insights into the true character of America's first families like the people who serve their meals and make their beds. The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House by Kate Anderson Brower, reveals daily life as it's really lived through the voices of the maids, butlers, cooks, florists, doormen, engineers, and others who tend to the needs of the president and the first family. These dedicated professionals maintain the mansion's 6 floors, 132 rooms, 35 bathrooms, 28 fireplaces, 3 elevators, and 8 staircases, and prepare everything from hors d'oeuvres for intimate gatherings to elaborate state dinners. Over the course of the day, they gather in the lower level's basement kitchen to share stories, trade secrets, forge lifelong friendships, and sometimes even fall in love. Combining incredible first-person anecdotes from extensive interviews with scores of White House staff and archival research, Brower tells their story. She reveals the intimacy between the first family and the people who serve them, as well as tension that has shaken the staff over the decades. The Residence, narrated by Karen White, is full of surprising and moving details that illuminate day-to-day life at the White House.
There has been no transition in modern memory as shocking as the sudden and violent upheaval that brought the arrival of Lyndon B. Johnson and his family to the White House. The Residence staff had to help a devastated First Lady and her 2 children move out, even as they were grieving themselves, and at the same time they had to help the Johnsons move in. And it all had to be done without making Mrs. Kennedy feel rushed or the Johnsons feel as though they were being ignored. I've been on panels with other social secretaries, and they make it all sound so exciting when they got there, says Lady Bird's social secretary, Bess Abel, a Katharine Hepburn-esque presence who speaks with great affection about the Johnsons. I moved into the White House on an entirely different occasion. Instead of coming in with the excitement and the thrill of an inauguration, we moved into a house that was covered with black crepe on all the chandeliers and the columns. The new First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson, often lamented the difficult position her family were suddenly thrust into. "People see the living and wish for the dead," she'd say. Out of respect for the president's widow, Lyndon B. Johnson, who was largely disliked by Kennedy's staff, did not move into the White House until December 7, 1963. He started working out of the Oval Office on November 26th. Before then, he worked out of room 274 in the old executive office building next door to the White House. Some of Johnson's advisors argued that moving into the residence on December 7th, the 22nd anniversary of the horrific attack on Pearl Harbor, would be disrespectful. Others simply wanted to give Mrs. Kennedy more time before leaving the White House. Every move the Johnsons made must have been excruciating, since nothing they did could help endear them to President Kennedy's heartbroken aides. Lucy Baines Johnson, just 16 years old at the time, remembers eavesdropping as her parents had what she called the only argument she can remember them ever having. "We have to move December 7th, Bird," Johnson told his wife. "Lyndon, any day but that, any day but that," her mother pleaded, but in vain. When the Johnson family finally arrived, their daughter Lucy brought their beagles, him and her, in her convertible. Lady Bird and Bess and her press secretary, Liz Carpenter, brought breakable items, along with a portrait of House Speaker Sam Rayburn, a fellow Texan who was Johnson's mentor. At first, the Johnsons seemed to treat the White House gingerly, as though they were impinging on sacred ground. But the residence staff, unlike Kennedy's political aides, never made them feel like interlopers. "I never felt a sense of, 'How could you be here?' Lucy told me. It was, 'Oh, how tough to have you come here this way. How can we help? How can we teach?'" Not everyone was welcoming. After Kennedy's assassination, Trafees Bryant, an electrician who started caring for the first family's dogs with the Kennedys — they had 9 dogs at one point — and didn't stop until the Nixons, was wary of President Johnson. "I was losing a dog and gaining a president I didn't know. Not only didn't I know him, I didn't think I wanted to know him. He wasn't boyish or good-natured or quick-witted like Kennedy, and I heard him cussing out the help when things weren't done fast enough." Bryant describes the abrupt shift at the White House to accommodate the new president. "Terriers were out and beagles were in. Jackie Pink was out, Lady Bird Yellow was in. Chowder was out and Chili was in."
That was The Residence by Kate Anderson Brower. Readers, with the candidate pool growing each week, it's a challenge to keep current. Make sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, to see which new political titles are making headlines. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.